On this episode of the Music Bed Podcast, we sit down with director L. Brooks Tao. She's been awarded with a Cannes Gold Lion, a DNAD Yellow Pencil, and a Gold Clio for her work with McDonald's for International Women's Day. Other brands she's worked with include Nike, Adidas, and Comcast.
There's that question of, like, how much do you manipulate for a story?
Because filmmaking is manipulation.
It's manipulation.
Yeah, the whole thing is manipulation.
Complete manipulation. We're all master manipulators.
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard in music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. To create your free account today, go to musicbed.com.
We go way back, but I want to hear sort of like, you know, what do you do? Like, what is your, you know, your role kind of in film? Mm-hmm. And maybe tell us how you got your start in actually like the filmmaking and directing.
Yeah, I currently direct, sometimes commercials. Finished a feature documentary that has yet to be seen.
Cool.
We'll see if it comes out. and a few narratives for a nonprofit. I guess if you say you direct, you can direct whatever you want to.
Yeah.
So, and then how I got my start, I kind of worked through a crew from the ground up. And so it all started on a whale watching boat.
Yeah.
And then I got hired to be an extra. And then I went from an extra to a PA. And then a PA back to a waitress, which then drove me to go get a job at a rental house and learn gear. And then I worked my way through camera. And then I started ghostwriting. And then I saved up enough pennies to do some work that I guess made me a director.
Yeah. I always thought it was interesting because the first time I met you, I think you were just camera. I think you were like first AC in for Khalid or something.
Yeah, here and there.
Yeah.
Here and there.
And that's where I met you. And then we didn't stay in touch for a couple of years. And then the next time I saw you, you were directing and it was like incredible stuff. And I'm like, where did this come from? You know what I mean? Like, how did this happen?
Desperation.
Because I didn't even know that you wanted to be a director or if that, you know, it's always like something that, you know, I think if you're like an aspiring director, you're not always like, hey, I'm a director. Like, please talk to me. You know,
I was terrified to call myself a director.
Yeah.
I think it was probably Music Bed, like an article, the first time that someone in print called me a director.
Really?
And I think that honestly gave me the confidence to be like, okay, I guess I'm a director now since someone else said it.
Yeah.
But up until then, I was working under so many people that I was really intimidated by and respected so much. And I was like, oh, I can never release anything. This is terrifying.
Yeah. You were in a circle of directors and filmmakers that are some of the best in the world. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like John Bragel and Khalid and all those guys are like so good.
Yeah.
That I'm always intimidated every time that I meet those guys, and I've known them for a long time.
They're amazing. It was kind of it's weird to look back on because it was so long ago. It feels like such a blur. Especially because we were all like in our early 20s.
Yeah. So young.
just still working really hard. Like the first time I ever met Khalid, he was using a 5D.
Yeah. You know? Which is so long ago.
Yeah, it was so long ago. It's fun to think about, like, how much can change over time. I think there's a lot of hope to that, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder what was the first thing that you decided was like, okay, I'm going to direct this. I'm going to go out and I'm going to do this thing.
That was Why We Wake, actually. That's probably still the film I'm most proud of, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, it was based off of hearing a lot of conversations kind of in hushed whispers about depression or like, the idea of depression that a lot of filmmakers in my circle were dealing with.
Yeah.
And at the time, I don't think I really had struggled with real depression that I recognized. We'll put it that way. Now, like many years later, I would say, sure, there's been definite seasons. But back then, I think I was just like, someone needs to open up this conversation. And that was kind of my hope.
Yeah.
And so that was totally on like an all hands on deck. Did the film for around $3,000 that I didn't have. And I was terrified to release it. I didn't know if it was good or bad. I had no gauge of like with which to judge. Some people that I really respected hated it. Other people really liked it.
Yeah.
that was tough to hear, you know, the people who hate it. But I think that that was a good gauge for me, because even like little L, you know, I call her, who made that, I think it resonates, and I'm going to put it out anyway.
Right.
And I think to this day, honestly, I still get messages about that film being like, oh, I showed this to my therapist, or like, you know, I use this to describe what I'm feeling to my wife. And that's a good feeling. I feel like I haven't made a film since then that's actually done that, to be honest, which is a bad feeling.
Do you feel like great art has to be polarizing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. I think if everyone likes your film, maybe you haven't done something right.
Yeah.
Like maybe it's too pleasing. Yeah. But that's just me.
Which is the hard part about, especially in the world where, you know, there's like, you make a short or like experimental thing, and one of the only outlets is either film festivals or it's like Vimeo or Short of the Week or, you know, Amuleto or something like that. Like, there's going to be, I've recently put out something that was for the first time put out on YouTube through Short of the Week, and it's crazy the amount of difference between the people who watch things on YouTube versus what I would consider like my peers and whatever on like Vimeo.
The comments are so different.
Yes.
My favorite part is going through and screenshotting comments.
I love that, dude.
Like, it's amazing.
But I put out this thing and the comments are like mostly positive, and some people were like, yikes, not gonna watch this. And then some people like really give like a paragraph of like, because I think on YouTube, they're like thinking that other people are going to read, like people need these comments so they can understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Whereas on Vimeo or Instagram or something, it's like, great, good job, you know, heart, whatever. It's like just for you.
Yeah.
But for YouTube, I feel like people almost want to be a part of the communication of the thing.
Yeah.
Which is
very interesting. I appreciate that more.
Yeah, I do too.
Like, I put out a Buffalo Wild Wings commercial, the first commercial I did when I started directing commercials. Mm-hmm. And the comments on that thing on YouTube are so funny.
Really?
Like, they are all over the board funny. Like, some people just go in, like, a paragraph talking about how they just really want some chicken wings.
Yeah.
And it's, like, their life story. Like,
this in got response me hungry. To that. Yeah.
And then, like, Not to Be a Lady, which was a few years ago, the comments on that are hysterical too. Like, people were hating really hard in a few comments. And those are my favorite ones. Like, it didn't even bother me. I just thought it was so funny that someone would write so much. And like, to be honest, I would be sad if there weren't a few of those comments on a film.
Yeah.
Cause I feel like it's like, but you watched it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, like you kind of they stick out and almost, but that's so funny though, because you get like 100 good comments and then you get one or two and you're like,
the haters are my favorites. Yeah. So. I hope all the haters watch my stuff. Yeah.
What's going on in your life? Can you talk? Why are you so angry right now?
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard in music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. From indie artists on the rise to leading composers, MusicBed has curated the best roster of musicians for your films. Go to musicbed.com and use the promo code LBrooksTao to get your first month free on a standard subscription.
My feature doc probably will come out in the spring, and I've been preparing myself because it's about chronic illness, and the medical community is really, really divided about it. About like how to treat it, what it is. And you can't please everyone in that situation. And when we were filming, I would get text messages from like a doctor who, you know, was a friend of a friend of a friend of someone that was on my crew, and my phone number got given out. And there was like a few times that I'd get texted around 2 a.m. just being like, this is Dr. So-and-so. I heard you're making this documentary, and I just want to let you know that you're killing people if you release this.
No
like
way.
Like some very, very intense text messages.
And I'm so confused. So what was it? What's the premise of it, if you don't
mind? It's about Lyme disease, which we followed, which is like, it's like an immune disease that there's some very conflicting information on.
Like, it's essentially inflammation though, right? Of like the joints.
It's a lot like lupus, like if I could compare it to something. But it's so much more complicated than that. Okay. There's not like an easily diagnosable test for it. So you could have this, you could have all these other things that it leads to.
Okay.
So yeah, it's a very like abstract.
But why are they so upset? I don't understand.
I think everyone has their idea on how it's treated, how it's talked about. The name Lyme disease is super nonspecific. Like there's 65 different bacteria that could lead to these symptoms.
Okay.
So by calling it one thing, you're distracting from something else it could be. But then it's hard to diagnose and treat as well. There's a lot of people who are like experimenting on patients just to get their money.
Yeah, I see.
There's really like a dark side to the disease for sure, medically and with the patients. So we followed three people, all of different income levels and access to healthcare in different corners of the United States, trying to go about figuring out what they had, how to treat it, how to get access to care. Doctors in some states will lose their medical licenses if they treat it. Parents will have their kids taken away if they don't follow like medical advice, depending on what state you're in. I've heard everything at this point. So like, yeah, I'm mentally preparing myself to be ripped apart come May. But
from
I
just
feel
like the medical community and like, yeah.
Yeah. And like, who knows? I think in the process of making, like you've made, I feel like more doc than I have maybe, but
maybe, I don't know.
So you know what it's like when like you're trying to do a documentary, you have kind of a degree of like responsible journalism, but then you also can only fit so much into an hour and a half.
It can only really be an impression.
Yeah. It's an impression. That's a great word.
Yeah.
And then some people might be, it's more than that. For me, I feel like I learned a lot of lessons, like the next film I would do differently, of course.
Sure.
So there's just a lot of practice.
Is there anything
practice.
Practical lessons-wise that you would share?
So much. I mean, I think the development of a film and taking the time to properly develop a film is important. And I think that for this one, I jumped in, like, just head first. And I think that due diligence is now I would say like, I'm not in a rush. There's no rush to go make this particular film. Like I have no problem in waiting to do it right. Develop, maybe not make such finite decisions from the beginning of what a film is. And yeah, just be a little more open to what something can become. Get a lot more opinions along the way.
Yeah.
There's so much fun. I mean, let me list the ways.
Yeah.
I feel like I learned every lesson on this.
I think that's also, it's the subject is so important, you know,
because
I think you have to, because there is, especially with documentaries, there is like a journalistic, ethical sort of moral, like line that you're kind of writing, you know, where like, you know, you could be really in deep with like inner city kids and like it they're like poor and you're like, man, I really want to buy this family groceries, but I can't do that in order for me to remain sort of journalistically like ethical.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah.
But at the same time, like you need them to have fun and like, you know, feel like they're getting something out of it.
Yeah.
That's always hard, you know, is to like,
I think that is a tough thing about filmmaking when you're like, it's human relationship. Like films are built on human relationship, whether it's a narrative or a documentary. I think that they are. But if you're working with real people, right?
Yeah.
Like that was a problem that I had all the way through is one of the families was, they were living on, I think around $50 a month with four kids and a new baby. And to watch that and film it for like 2.5 years and stand by and feel like you're doing nothing for the ethical reason of like, if you pay them, there's rules around that, but also like you can't twist the storyline. And I mean, there's other ways that we figured out how to help once it was wrapped. More on that, you know, some other time. But like, I think that of all the things in my career, I think that is the thing that probably sent me into a tailspin.
Really?
To be honest. Like a massive moral inner conflict.
Yeah.
About this career. And
in terms of like capturing things like that, in the way that you were, or
yeah, like I think I learned I did not surround myself with enough support personally to do this film.
Yeah,
like there should have been more people involved, more emotional support involved, more therapy involved. And I think after I finished it, I read that documentary filmmakers have the highest degree of suicide in the film industry.
Really?
Yeah. Of anyone. Read it in multiple articles and spoke to a therapist who specializes actually with documentary directors. And it totally made sense to me because you're handling subjects that you kind of become their personal therapist without trying to, because you're trying to get at the story and like gain trust and get them to talk to you normally. And there's only so much that one person can handle with that, you know, directing.
Especially with the idea that some of it can be perceived as manipulation.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
Totally.
You know?
Totally. And then you're like, there's that question of like, how much do you manipulate for a story? Like, how can you plan ahead?
Is manipulation.
Like, it's manipulation.
Yeah. The whole thing is manipulation.
We're all master manipulators.
Yeah. I'm going to put it in camera and then I'm going to put it on a computer and then I'm going to move it all around and shake it up for it to make sense and to almost mean something more than it began with, you know? And that is manipulation, you know? But you try to manipulate for good things.
Yeah, I know.
You know, that's like the goal, obviously. Like,
I know. I really just, I want to do happy work. Like, I want to film happiness. Because I'm starting to realize, if it's taught me one thing, how much the world needs more happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we do like to laugh. It feels good. Yeah. You know, like we like to see ourselves reflected. And I'm drawn, I feel like I'm drawn to innately telling these like deeper, darker stories. But it's something I'm really trying to pull myself out of, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, filmmaking's so hard because it's like innately conflict.
Yeah.
You know, like every story, screenwriting book you ever read and every storybook you ever read, it's like more conflict, more this, more that. Unless it's comedy and then you do this.
Yeah.
You
know? It's like, exactly.
I would love to, and I hope that I can do stuff in the future that's like kind of blending the lines a little bit, you know? Because some of my favorite movies are like, especially this last year, a film like Bardo or something. It's like so funny. And Iñárritu is like very good at that sort of like blending of like, especially with like Birdman or something, like
Birdman is amazing.
You're hysterically laughing and then a moment later you're just engrossed in a performance and then it becomes like this emotional thing. I think that kind of blending is really special to see.
Like deep human truth that's interrupted by like reality.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Because reality is funny. Like, funny things happen all the time, especially in beautiful moments, you know? And there's probably a psychology there of like, to make somebody laugh makes it easier to give them some emotional key.
Yeah.
You know?
I feel like if we could all tell films the way that we talk at bars, we'd all be better filmmakers.
Yeah. What was like your favorite? Do you have like a documentary or. Yeah, let's say documentary that you saw that sort of inspired you, maybe in the last 10 years, 5 years, whatever.
I think, I mean, it's kind of an obvious one, I guess. Well, Free Solo, because Claire Popkin, who shot that, also worked with me on my doc, and we became super good friends through that. And so I think I just appreciated hearing all the stories behind what actually went into that film to make it what it is.
Yeah.
That just gave me a complete appreciation for how you tell a story, like an entertaining story within documentary. And then My Octopus Teacher.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
or is it God, The Octopus dude. Teacher?
I'm going to cry just thinking about that movie.
That was just such, that's like to your point earlier that subject matters.
Yeah.
I think that's like a huge lesson I also learned. Like some stories are worth telling, you know, and some stories are like entertaining and here's why. And The Octopus Teacher was just,
For people who don't know, my Octopus Teacher is beautiful. I think it's on Netflix.
I think so.
On Netflix, where this I don't even think he was a documentarian. I think he was just a guy.
Yeah, he's just a dude that went out and shot this film like, about this octopus.
he was like a a deep diver, but he would go without any, like, you know, he could hold his breath for like 6 minutes at a time or something. But he documents his like ongoing relationship with this one octopus in this very special cove next to his house. And it's the most saddest, most beautiful, like love story I've
love
ever
story.
Seen.
Yeah. It's like everyone is a sucker for a love story, even with an octopus. It's amazing.
Yeah. Cause it engrosses you in the life of like the smallest details of this octopus, you know, like, that's what I really appreciated about something like we were talking about the whale earlier. There's, if you've seen it, right? No, you haven't seen it.
No.
So it all takes place in this house, in basically a single room for probably an hour and 40 minutes. And they don't really try to go anywhere else. Like sometimes you get like the porch or like this one sort of bedroom thing.
Yeah.
But they don't. They mainly stay in this one living room area because he's confined to this area, and the smallest things that happen begin to feel like huge story elements.
Yeah.
Like at one point, he gets a wheelchair, and just the fact of him moving to this wheelchair, like the audience goes like, "Oh, like we're like moving forward, like things are changing," and you get this like whole lift in the movie when he gets this wheelchair. But he literally just went from here to there. But it's like...
But you're like cheering him on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the smallest little things. I love stories that are confined like that. You know?
Same. I saw Women Talking. Have you seen that? Mm-mm. Okay. I got to give you the screen.
With Frances McDormand?
Yeah.
Rooney Mara?
It's like that. Like 97% of the movie takes place in a barn.
Wow.
And it's just women from the same community who one night, without giving it all away, you know, or any of it away, don't worry.
Yeah. No spoilers.
Basically, yeah. If you've read the description log line to watch it, you'll know this, but like a group of women were all assaulted on the same night, drugged and assaulted. And then they woke up and they're discussing whether to stay or leave. And it's kind of, I forget, Mennonite or Quaker community. And they're like, well, if all the women leave, then like the community can't exist without us. Mm-hmm. And it was just banter back and forth, discussing pros, cons, all based around the idea of, do we forgive or do we leave?
Yeah.
Or do we forgive and leave? And all taking place within this one location. It was the first movie in a while that's made me cry.
Yeah.
Partly because I wish that I thought of the idea. Just kidding. But no, it was so, so good and so moving, and it hit you in so many just deeply human ways. And I think I've always resonated with your work a lot. Really? And I feel like we're drawn to like similar nuances that we want to like zone in on. Mm-hmm. And probably that's why you like The Whale. And now I want to watch The Whale. And now you have to watch Women Talking.
I do. Yeah. I'm going to see it when while I'm here.
Like very simple storylines where the small things become huge, you know, and celebrated.
Yeah. I mean, I think you feel, when I look at your work, there's like all this sensitivity in it, you know, and I know that that's just you. And like, I think you were right. Like what you said earlier, I'm drawn to that work just because it's just like, it almost like it feels like a specific part in your heart that like that kind of work just sits in, you know, and it's like a weight. That's what all my like closest peers have always talked about my work is like having like a weight to it, you know?
Yeah.
And I see the same in your work. That's like, but I think it's because of all the things that you go through in your life, you know?
There's been like, thank you for saying that. That's so nice. I am really glad that comes through. I think there is an empathy that I was raised to have. And also like a childhood that I wasn't around very many people. I didn't go to school until middle school, like real school. And my mom had quite a few medical problems growing up. And so there was a lot of isolation. And for like an extroverted kid, that's tough. And I feel like I just got used to watching everything and reading like National Geographic, you know, cover to cover many times over, like Reader's Digest cover to cover many times over, and just relying on daydreaming. And I think something comes from that in just like honing in on what people are innately feeling, mm-hmm. you know, and based on what they look like or what you see them doing and what you observe them doing. And I don't know, I'm glad that hopefully some of that has been captured. I think there is a degree where I feel like as a filmmaker, what's in your heart comes out. Mm-hmm. And you can look at pieces of work that you've made over the seasons and probably recognize themes yeah. in like the person that you were.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm kind of excited for all of us in like 10 years, if we were to sit back yeah. down and talk, what's what's been made.
I think we'll see a lot of pretension and yeah. a lot of soul at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
It's like that young insecurity. That young work. Yeah, it feels insecure, gosh. But like you're swinging for shit.
Yeah, you know? You're swinging for the fences. I know it's tough because it's like the know-it-alls, you know, the young know-it-alls who like think that they're the best filmmaker ever. Yeah. Sometimes they do make something great.
Right.
Because they're not afraid to just like take a big swing.
Right.
I feel like it's important to still access that. And then sometimes I feel like you've learned so much that it's hard to let go of it sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you this. I feel like with a lot of commercial directors or people who do a lot of commercials, I feel like more times than not, it seems rather hard for them to get out of that, to do something
yeah.
for no money or for a passion project or something, where they're not spending $100,000 on something. You know what I mean? Like, where do you fall in your sort of...
I have so many thoughts about this. Where do I fall in thought process or like,
yeah, like what,
actually on that
board? Yeah, like what do you want to be? But actually, like how does it shake down sort of practically for you?
Like how many commercials do I need to do to be stable? Or like what, like if I did a personal project, how much would it cost?
Even less a question about you.
Yeah.
More of a question about like the commercial directing like game. Mm. You know what I mean?
I feel like the blessing of commercials is that once you figure it out, you know how it's done.
Yeah.
Right? And it feels fairly predictable. And you get to develop your skills on like sets that are going to give you money to use tools and hire certain yeah. DPs or whatever and like practice.
Yeah.
In a fairly safe world and meet people that are new and different every day. But I think the problem with commercials, especially if you do them a lot, and I mean, I'm talking about myself for sure, is that you can get so sucked into the rigmarole mm-hmm. around it. Like the fear of never being able to take a month off because that might be 2 or 3 months or more of work that you're going to miss out on.
Yeah.
Which has been a huge for me, like this year is actually about allowing for more life to happen.
Yeah.
And then in addition to that, I think that sometimes we can spend so much money on personal projects hoping to get commercials out of them.
Yeah.
And sometimes that does happen. And when it happens, it's a great feeling. But I would say more times than not, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And then we feel this pressure based on what we're seeing on Instagram, or what other people are putting out that we don't really have insight into how that's getting funded, what favors they're pulling, so on, that it's like, did that cost $5,000 or right. did that cost $50,000? Right. And are they self-paying for it or yeah. are other people paying for it? And if other people are paying for it, how?
Yeah.
And
the mystery is what people, like, the I feel mystery. Like people love that shit though.
Yeah.
Especially the people putting things out. It's like they don't want to communicate all the in-betweens.
I'm such an open book about that stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like it's not... Maybe it sells to keep the mystery, but I just feel like it's so not healthy. Yeah. I also... All the projects that I've done have been under 10K. Mm-hmm. And I don't even... I have like an issue... Unless it's a short narrative film or just any short film... that you're making, that you are making for your art and because you believe in it, then any investment is great yeah. into that. But I think there should be like a cutoff point financially for how much money gets put in. if it's only done with the sole goal of like getting a commercial out of it, I guess.
Yeah.
This is just my personal feelings.
I also think like the kind of work that you end up making where it's like pseudo spec, pseudo passion project is so one thing.
Yeah.
It's so narrow of a kind of project that you can do that can really work for both, you know?
Yeah. And I'm not even sure. Vimeo has changed over the last, since we started.
Yeah.
You know?
It's changed a lot.
Like the ways that people are watching things and why they're watching things, I think have changed. I rarely go on Vimeo anymore. Short of the Week is still great, like to get eyes and stuff, but I rarely go on.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you the last thing that I watched unless it was a friend of mine that put it out.
Right.
Which I'm not sure if that's healthy or not. But I guess I feel like the quality, you could do this super stylized quality thing, but we need to figure out different outlets to get it actually seen.
Yeah.
If we're going to spend money on it. Like the most satisfying project that I personally worked on the last few years was this little thing I shot on my phone with my friend Stefania Excelsior that during COVID when it shut down, I was always inspired by the movie Drive.
Yeah.
Like you said.
Yeah.
You know, and the director and Ryan Gosling for like, I think about 2 months, every night at midnight, they would drive around LA together and talk about the movie.
Wow.
And they just vibed LA.
Yeah.
And I told Stefania during COVID, the first 2 weeks that New York shut down, let's vibe this time. We've got nothing else to do. And we took our cell phones. That's all we had.
Yeah.
And filmed stuff and interviewed random people about how they were feeling and kind of just shot this like mood piece of COVID and recorded phone calls with our parents and families and friends. And I think that it still made people feel something. And like, no, I'm not going to go shoot a narrative in the same way as I would go shoot that film. But
right.
I was at Sundance and Justin Chan said this. Like someone in the audience, Justin Chan, like directed, wrote, acted Blue Bayou, you know, and a few others. And someone was like, what's your biggest advice, you know, for just like getting a film off the ground? And he's like, man, just go shoot something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's underestimated. And like, I love the people who go and spend $100,000 to like prove their skills. And if you're going to do VFX work, sci-fi and stuff like that, 100% necessary. But like, I don't know. For me, I'm like, if I can shoot something super stylized that looks like it costs $100,000 and it doesn't make you feel anything, there's a problem with me relying on tools that take away from a different tool that I should be developing.
Yeah.
That was a long answer.
Yeah. Well, no, and I think, I mean, Justin's such a good example. You've seen Blue Bayou.
I love Blue Bayou.
It's shot in my neighborhood.
Oh, like in New Orleans.
Like that bridge right there is like 2 blocks away from my house.
Oh, wow.
So when I was watching, I was so pissed because I haven't shot that stuff yet.
Oh, like, man. And was that the concept that you wish you'd...
No, it has nothing to do with the concept.
Yeah.
Just everything to do with the visuals of my neighborhood. He just got it first. Because that's like the only thing that you would shoot in that neighborhood. It's like on that street with that bridge, like with New Orleans in the background. And I'm just like... I can't shoot that at Twilight. I can't shoot it at Twilight anymore because that's your fucking poster. I'm like,
look, if you make it personal,
I know,
it's going to be through Christian's eyes.
It would be totally different either way, but also that's how that movie feels. It's just like, it's very like Blue Valentine as well. Like this, like, let's just grab, you know, slices of life. It's more about character and like performance and less about being sexy and making the visuals look something. Like, you know, like $1 million movie.
Yeah.
You know, I love that mentality.
Yeah. But you were asking, I feel like I veered away actually by accident. You're asking about commercials versus like personal projects, right?
Yeah. I feel like there's this game to be, that I see a lot of people playing that I think is misguided, you know, and whether it's like them spending a lot of money on a short film where me and you know, like very well that like you're really probably only at your best chance is to get this amount of views for something that you're spending $80,000, $100,000 on.
Yeah.
I get it if it's like you know, you have an in to somebody who's head of production at Netflix or something and you're like making a proof of concept to like send to them. I get that. You're like taking a big swing or whatever. But whenever I see people making $80,000 shorts, I'm like, you could have just made a feature.
Yeah.
You know, you could have just spent that money on 15 days with your small crew.
Yeah.
And everybody just did a passion project, but you had a movie now.
Yeah.
And you could put that movie into a film festival and it could surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
Where like the biggest thing that you're going to get from a short is like, yeah, like getting into Sundance or like whatever, but even like winning a short at Sundance is like probably the biggest thing that you could do for a short in the, in the world, maybe, you know, or can or something.
Yeah.
But like, that's so rare. Or you could just make a feature and just take a swing.
Take a swing. Yeah, totally.
But it's hard for directors, especially on the commercial side, who are used to getting paid 15, 20, 25 grand a day.
Yeah.
To like...
do things any differently.
Yeah. Well, you mean I can't have 60 feet of track?
And yeah.
I can't have a steady cam just waiting for me, you know, or like a techno crane, like just to do this thing. I'm like, no, it's... put it on your shoulder or put it on a lazy Susan, spin it around. Like, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. We shot a short here in my bedroom.
Yeah.
And we literally lugged in a lazy Susan and like put people on it. And like everything was done in that one room.
Yeah.
And with 9 friends, and it was the best.
Where's it at? Is it out?
It's gonna be.
Do you sit like on this week? Do you like to sit on stuff like,
no, honestly, I don't like to sit on stuff, but I think when you shoot, when you take time to shoot something, and then I think there's this like rush to get back to work to make up for time lost.
Sure.
And so suddenly like your priorities, it's maybe number 5 in the time of your day to get like a personal project edited and colored and sound designed. And sometimes I think I've put things out too fast and it genuinely has affected the quality. So to some degree, I'm trying to take things a little slower and do things right.
Yeah.
But yeah, Insomnia will be out this week.
Insomnia.
Yeah. But it was like one of those confined, trippy, it's trippy camera work, but honestly, we did it with almost nothing.
Yeah.
Props to the DP.
When did you guys shoot it?
We shot it last year, like almost a year ago.
You guys used a lazy Susan?
So, well, actually it was a turntable. Okay. Wrong name. It was a turntable and we did rent that. That was like the one piece of equipment that we rented. It's probably $500.
What was the effect that you were trying to do though?
We were trying to make it just feel, it was a close up on faces.
Okay.
Almost moonlight style, but then we wanted them spinning. And so we put them across from each other. It was like a couple looking at each other. And then we put weird lights. It's quite trippy.
Are they tripping on acid or something?
No, it's about a couple like going through a kind of unwanted breakup due to not addressing like personal issues, one of which is insomnia. So it's kind of, we go into this dream world where kind of when your brain goes crazy when you can't sleep, it's like a fever dream. And so this is part of their fever dream where they're just like spinning, you know, you're spinning and everything is moving so fast and you don't feel like you have control of it. So it's like mice in a maze, you know, and like spinning against this abstract background, which is actually just my bedroom with, you know, overblown at 360 shutter.
Yeah.
But yeah.
it was so cool. So for when this drops, this will Insomnia will already be out. So you can go see it probably on
Vimeo.
Your website, Vimeo. Yeah. Check it out.
And probably Film Supply.
Yeah. How does music sort of like affect your creative process?
I always wanted to be a musician and really? I'm not a very good one. Like I always wished I could sing. And my mom tried to put me in singing lessons as a kid and I was paralyzingly shy as a child, which is probably hard to imagine now, but like very, very shy. And so I never pursued that, but I think that I've always thought about films as, if I could like pour my heart out in song, what would that look like as a film?
Yeah.
Where it's just totally, it's just emotionally resonant in the same way that music is. But to get there, music zens me out. And I have to find music. Like when I hit the right music and I couldn't say exactly what or why, like suddenly ideas just start flowing and I'll search for days or weeks sometimes just to like find that song that triggers an idea. Rick Rubin actually just did a podcast about this.
Really?
Yeah.
What did he say? What was he saying?
He was saying that there's like legit frequencies or subconscious creativity that like basically matches
like
the
wavelength.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Like the way like that we're on, and it's real. And I think if you were to talk to like music scientists,
Rick Rubin, dude.
Oh my gosh, Rick Rubin, my heart.
I love that man. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Let's talk about Rick Rubin.
I watched something on YouTube where I think it was, who's the journalist that has like very handsome, like gray hair, but like just like almost like a high and tight.
Haberman? Oh, Haberman? Is that his name?
I think he does 60 Minutes.
This podcast might have been between him and Rick Rubin, actually.
But he was essentially like, do you play music? Like, can you play instruments? He's like, barely.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, so, like, what are your qualifications? He's like, I'm very unqualified. But like, what he has is this like curiosity. That's
yeah.
it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think music inspires me, and then music changes your film into what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like, I know some people start with music. If I played music, I probably would too. But I feel like music can change your film for the better, because music makes us feel things. Like, music is a love story to our souls. I really think that sounds cheesy, but something about us connects with it and as an expression. And I don't think, like, sometimes I want to let my films have no music and just force you to sit and listen in uncomfortable sound. But then anytime that music does start to come in, what a difference, you know?
Yeah.
And music also echoes life, I think. Like, I love, did you see, what's the war movie about winter that I'm forgetting the title of?
All Along the Western Front?
Yes.
I think that was such a slept on movie last year.
Man,
I mean, I know it's nominated for an Oscar and whatever, but sometimes I feel like Netflix just drops the fucking ball on that shit.
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
But that score was such a brave...
With the guitar.
Yes.
It's like electric, distorted guitar.
Yeah, it's such a brave score.
Yeah.
But I felt like they were trying to say, like, almost emulate this jarring sound of explosions.
Yeah.
Or rumbles. At least for me, that's what I got from it. And it did the trick. Like, I felt overstimulated because I never knew when that... Wah! Was gonna come. It's the same freaking thing with The Lighthouse. Yeah. I was trying to score my doc at the day after I watched The Lighthouse, and I was so mad at my friend at Diego Contreras. I was so mad at him for inviting me over to watch that, because I couldn't get the sound of the boat out of my head, like the boat horn that is in most of the score for like 3 hours. It's just this whomp. And I remember as I was like talking with my composer, and I was like, you know what we need here? We just need like a wah. And he's like, I don't really think we do. And I'm like, oh yeah, I think I'm just saying that because I just watched The Lighthouse. Yeah. Like, it was horrible anyway.
How do you like figure out your way through the comparison game?
What initially came to mind is that I have always hated comparing myself to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like it's been as much of a problem for me because I have this like aversion. Like, I've given up on you accepting me because I don't expect you to anyway. Yeah. Like, that kind of, like, unhealthy, you know, bullied kid in middle school attitude. Like, but I think in reality, there's something in me that tries not very hard not to think about it, because then the work won't be original anymore. And it's, like, always at the forefront of my mind. But I think when it comes to opportunity, like, I don't feel like I honestly don't care if people like my work. And I think that got broken off in my 20s really early when a lot of people didn't like my work. I stopped caring.
Yeah.
And then like Rick Rubin said, he's always looking for the rule breaker, the person that's like flipping a middle finger off to the world, because that's the kid that he wants to work with.
Yeah.
And I've always kind of felt that way. Like, you don't like it, whatever, moving on. But I think where I do get hung up in comparison is with opportunity given, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because it's hard not to look at something and say, I could have done that. I don't understand why I wasn't given that opportunity. Or what's the game that I have to play? If it's not the quality of your work, what's the game?
Yeah.
Like that age-old question that I think all of us wonder about. It's tough sometimes not to get stuck there. And I think I've also had to realize that there is a humility to be found when you just keep making and be like, oh, maybe this is why it didn't happen, or maybe this is why it didn't happen. Because if I keep making, I'm being humbled in what I'm learning. Maybe I'm not that good, or maybe I wasn't right for that, or thank goodness I didn't get, you know, this opportunity. But no, I'd say that's the stuck part. And my response is to go do something that I'm really scared of doing.
Yeah.
Like I don't write narrative that much, but this last year I fell in with a group when I moved to LA that does. And they were so open. My friend Sam Hodges, especially, like, he really, really encouraged me consistently. Like, you're a good writer. You're funny. Like, what do you mean that's not good? That's good. You know? And it was just enough. Like when you find that older kid in school who like suddenly makes you walk with like a slightly better swagger. and then a project from this nonprofit A21 came along, and it was the first narrative that I'd, not the first narrative I'd written, but the first narrative that I was going to write and make. Mm-hmm. Put it that way. And I'm stoked with how it turned out, but I was really intimidated the whole time.
Yeah.
For sure. But then I was like, oh, wow, I have such a bigger respect for these people that I see getting these jobs. And maybe I'll work my way into it.
What are three essential tools for your creative process?
Music. Mm-hmm. Just like listening to music. Conversation. I think conversation and curiosity. Honestly.
Yeah.
I think without curiosity, it's really hard to make things. I am not an internal thinker, as you can probably see from this podcast. So I feel like I literally cannot develop ideas on the inside of me. Like, that is not how I'm wired. So yeah, curiosity, conversation, and music to like inspire.
Yeah. Love that. what is one scene from a movie or a TV show where music elevated the moment?
Ooh. 000 Mogwai.
What movie is that?
It's a TV show. And it all takes place.
Mogwai
did the score.
Right, okay.
For 000. And it was like, I'm not sure how he did it, but to me it was about drugs and death and family discord. Yeah. And it felt like there was a lot of like razor blade sounds used mixed with violin. And it was this like sharp kind of, it was just like beautiful violin that kind of sounded like a rusty razor blade at the same time. Like, it kind of evoked this feeling of love and death at once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. What is one piece of career advice that you wish you heard earlier?
Try to keep your balance. Everyone told me that you're going to be working three jobs all at once, all the time. Get used to it. And that was good advice at the time, because I did for a very long time. And I don't think I slept very much at all in my 20s. And even now I'm not sleeping much at all in my 30s. And I think that there is that expectation of like, if you're in this industry, you better hustle. But no one ever really told me to like protect your personal life. And I've made such major mistakes with protecting my personal life and being a workaholic and like not valuing things that really truly are like going to matter in the moment. So yeah, I wish more people had said, protect your balance.
Yeah.
I just think the nature is like, people are going to tell you, oh my gosh, hustle, 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 or you don't belong.
Yeah.
We're all doing it. So keep up.
I feel like this is a subject that you need to cover in like film school or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
That and like how to navigate like a festival or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There's so much intimidation. Like, if you take time off, you're not going to get work.
Yeah.
If you don't make yourself available, people are going to forget your name. If you're not constantly putting work out, then what are you making? You know, how do you know your voice if you're not making work? There's all these comments that are meant to be said to us as guidance that if we take it too far, I think really, really destroy our creativity and our happiness. Yeah. It's really depressing. I don't mean it to be depressing.
No, I agree though.
It makes me angry. And so I'm like, protect your balance.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think we can be healthy filmmakers if we're not healthy people. Although I guess a lot of the poets were pretty miserable.
if you had to choose a different career path, what would it be?
I think I'd be like woodworking.
Making tables and furniture.
Yeah. Or like teaching little kids how to surf. I think it would be nothing to do with a film.
Yeah.
Maybe an author. But no, I think I would run as far away from the film industry as I could, honestly. I always think about that. Actually, I probably would be doing humanitarian work and making like no money at all a year and just trying to like leave some good behind.
Yeah.
Genuinely. I think, yeah.
What's something you always bring to set?
My coffee.
The cup of joe.
The cup of joe. That might change because I just stopped drinking caffeine. But legitimately, the cup of joe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think there's any other constant.
Well, Elle, it's always so fun to talk to you.
It's you been too.
Too long. And it's been thanks way for too having long us. Since we,
oh, sorry. I'm talking over you.
No, thanks for having us at your house. appreciate you letting us in and chatting with us.
It's been way too long since we caught up.
I know. Let's make sure to not have it be as long next
yes,
time.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Thanks, Christian. This was fun.
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard of music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with another filmmaker you know and subscribe to be notified for the next episodes.